Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, last week we previewed the 2026 Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities taking place in Eatonville. This week we'll discuss Hurston's life and career.
For Zora Neale Hurston, Eatonville represents the quintessential cultural impact that people of African ancestry, particularly rural southern people in this country, contribute to the culture of the United States.
We'll talk with Evan Noe about his new book, Aggression and Sufferings, Settler Violence, Native Resistance, and the Coalescence of the Old South.
We often sort of forget about Florida, especially when we're talking about the 19th century South, often in preference for places like Alabama or Mississippi or even Texas.
All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
When I get in Illinois, I'm going to spread the news about the Florida boys. Shove it over.
In the 1930s and 40s, writer, folklorist, and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston was a celebrated figure of the Harlem Renaissance. Hurston is best known for her 1937 novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Her other novels include Jonah's Gourdvine, Moses, Man of the Mountain, and Seraph on the Suwannee. As an anthropologist who studied under the renowned Franz Boas, Hurston published two collections of folklore, Mules and Men and Tell My Horse. Hurston also wrote dozens of short stories, essays, and dramatic works. The Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities has been held since 1990 in Eatonville, the oldest incorporated town governed entirely by African Americans. N.Y. Nathiri is founding director of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community and the Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities.
For Zora Neale Hurston, Eatonville represents the quintessential cultural impact that people of African ancestry, particularly rural southern people in this country, contribute to the culture of the United States. And because she grew up in Eatonville, an all-black community, where there was not artificial lens of viewing people, as she says in Mules and Men, in Eatonville, you got what your strengths brought you. If you were an energetic, aggressive, productive person, then that's who you were. If you were a lazy, no-count, ne'er-do-well, that's who you were, and you couldn't use as an excuse what they or the outside society did to you or against you. And at the same time, as a trained observer, as a person who had studied under Dr. Franz Boas, a father of American anthropology, as a person who had access to her native village and that community, she recognized the beauty, the intrinsic beauty of the people of her heritage group, and not only recognized that beauty, but was able to present it in a way that others can recognize it. Perhaps not so much during her lifetime with her contemporaries in Harlem, some of whom thought that she was entirely too folksy, but the point is that work that is truly of merit lives. And today, Zora Neale Hurston's work, her literature, her genius is acknowledged and celebrated throughout the literary world.
Zora Neale Hurston's literary career began even before she graduated from Barnard College in 1927. In 1925, Hurston's short story Spunk was included in a respected anthology called The New Negro. While attending college in New York, Hurston worked with Harlem Renaissance contemporaries including Langston Hughes and Wallace Thurman on the literary magazine Fire. After earning her Bachelor of Arts degree in anthropology, Hurston continued her graduate studies at Columbia University. In 1929, Hurston moved to the quiet town of Ogalle in Brevard County, Florida, to write her first and most important collection of African-American folklore. Florence M. Turcotte is literary manuscripts archivist at the University of Florida.
Zora came to Ogalle in April of 1929, and her goal was to find a little place where she could write and she could have peace and quiet. She found that in a one-room cottage here in Ogalle, and she rented it. She had a pretty good rental agreement, and she used that time to fish in the Indian River and to enjoy nature, and she put together her folklore stories in a book which was published called Mules and Men.
Virginia Lynn Moylan is author of the book Zora Neale Hurston's Final Decade, published by University Press of Florida.
The book Mules and Men was published in 1935 and was essentially a nonfiction account of Hurston's adventures and experiences as a folklorist and anthropologist in the late 1920s and early 1930s. It's divided into two sections. The first section is devoted to her experiences in Eatonville collecting folklore, and includes 70 of her glorious folktales, including Why Women Always Take Advantage of Men. The second section covers the period that she did research in New Orleans into hoodoo religion and practices, and even became a priestess. And the book is important not just from the standpoint of its entertainment value, but it was the first book of folklore that recorded the tales exactly as they were spoken. And today it is still considered the preeminent collection of African American folklore.
In 1937, Zora Neale Hurston wrote her best-known and much-loved work, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Flo Turcotte, Lynn Moylan, and N.Y. Nathiri.
Their Eyes Were Watching God is just, it's history, it's fiction, it's pathos, it's tragedy, all rolled up together in one incredible literary gem. And making history come alive is sort of what I'd like to do, and what Zora, that's what excites me so much about Zora, is that she fictionalized real life and said a lot about the human condition and a lot about life in Florida during her stay here.
My personal favorite work of Hurston's is by far Their Eyes Are Watching God. It's a beautiful novel. It's a love story about a woman who not only finds her true love, but she finds her own inner strength and her voice. And it just doesn't get any better than that.
Zora Neale Hurston is a part of my family lore. I did not really understand who she was in the literary realm until I was older. I actually read Their Eyes Are Watching God after our first son was born. That book was a Penguin classic that cost 99 cents. And when I was trying to, while my son was napping, that's how I read that book. I know Zora Neale Hurston from my mother's mother telling us about her companionship with Zora Neale Hurston, sometimes scaring me with folk tales from Zora Neale Hurston. In fact, my husband did literary research on Zora Neale Hurston. There are any number of people that were around me over a period of time, but I did not truly come to understand who she was until I read that book, and then began to reconnect some of the impact that she had.
Throughout the 1930s and 40s, Zora Neale Hurston was celebrated as an accomplished and sometimes controversial writer, folklorist, and anthropologist. In 1948, Hurston was devastated when she was falsely accused of molesting the 10-year-old son of her former Harlem landlady. The charges were dismissed and the boy recanted his claims, but Hurston's reputation and career were destroyed. And why Nethery?
She was falsely accused of molestation of a young boy. Falsely accused, completely vindicated, because she was not in the United States when the alleged abuse occurred or crime occurred. But the black press picked up the story after she was vindicated and really ruined her reputation. I think that she fled back to her home state.
After leaving New York, Hurston lived briefly in Miami and Belgrade before moving to Brevard County. She moved into the same O'Galley cottage where she had been happy and productive at the beginning of her career. When Hurston was unable to purchase her cottage in O'Galley, she moved to an apartment in Cocoa and then to a trailer on Merritt Island. During this period, she worked as a librarian. Virginia Lynn Moylan.
Hurston was fired from Patrick Air Force Base as a technical librarian, basically because she supported a whistleblower colleague who had turned in one of his supervisors for destroying documents without going through the proper authorization. So she collected unemployment for a while and finally was offered a job by a man named C.E. Bolin, who had founded a newspaper in Fort Pierce called the Fort Pierce Chronicle. So she moved very soon afterward and went to Fort Pierce to take the job in 1957.
Zora Neale Hurston died in January 1960 in the St. Lucie County Welfare Home. She was broke, forgotten, and her books were out of print. Florence M. Turcotte.
She was a ward of the county, and when she died, her effects thus were ordered burned. They were ordered destroyed. Nobody had come forward to claim them. A friend of hers, who was a sheriff's deputy, was going by the nursing home at the time and stopped and literally doused the flames and saved a bunch of her manuscripts that were about to be destroyed.
Today, Zora Neale Hurston is more popular than ever. As N.Y. Nethery explains, Zora Neale Hurston's work is now taught in high schools and colleges around the world.
An IB International Baccalaureate teacher of 11th grade students in Hampton, Virginia, is planning to bring her students to Eatonville for a field trip. And as we were talking about the planning and the budget, I said, well, will they be doing Disney or Universal? She said, no, we're coming to Eatonville, and that's the only reason that we're coming to Florida, is coming to Eatonville, and after we do this day, then we will be returning. So it's quite interesting to see that now, if you're going to be educated, you have to have read Zora Neale Hurston.
We spoke with Virginia Lynn Moylan, author of the book Zora Neale Hurston's Final Decade, Florence M. Turcotte, literary manuscripts archivist at the University of Florida, and N.Y. Nethery, founding director of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community and the Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities.
The captain got a pistol, he tried to play bad, but I'm gonna take it if it make me mad, or shove it over. Hey, hey, oh, can't you lie there? Ah, shack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a, ah, can't you move it? Hey, 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 oh, can't you try?
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org, where you can watch archived editions of our public television series, Florida Frontiers. Recent episodes include French Fort Caroline, built in 1564, the Ma Barker House, site of an infamous FBI shootout in 1935, and Henry Flagler, about the visionary 19th century industrialist. That's myfloridahistory.org. That's a 1940 recording of a Seminole hunting song. A new book by Evan Noe demonstrates how different groups of settlers in Florida and other southern states united for the common cause of dislocating Native Americans through violence. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Dr. F. Evan Noe is an assistant professor of history at the University of South Carolina, Lancaster. He serves as the historian for the university campus's Native American Studies Center. He recently completed a new book titled Aggression and Sufferings, Settler Violence, Native Resistance, and the Coalescence of the Old South, published by the University of Alabama Press. The book advances new insights regarding how central Native dispossession and the erasure of indigenous communities, initially through violence and then historical memory, proved in how white settlers coalesced a region-based identity before the American Civil War.
Coalescence is traditionally an anthropological term used to explain the coming together of different indigenous communities, often forging closer bonds in response to the pressures of colonialism. I sort of saw this as useful through an interdisciplinary framework. I'm a historian by trade, but I also have focus and training in something we refer to as ethnohistory, a sort of an interdisciplinary application of understanding Native peoples through certainly history, but also anthropology and archaeology. So that's sort of what introduced me to this model of coalescence. And it has been exclusively applied to indigenous peoples. And for me, it provided a useful framework about how it can be applied to white Southerners as well, to the colonizing population of this region. It's sort of emphasis on a process, sort of a continually idea of becoming a people. It's not necessarily focused on a product in terms of becoming a state or a nation or an independence movement. It's very identity-based, so it offered a lot of applicability. And we often see through processes of coalescence, a centrality of violence. The coalescence of other indigenous peoples is this generative power of violence. So we often think of violence as sort of destroying things, but in that destruction comes recreation. And so for white Southerners, in this violence that is perpetrated against indigenous people begins to serve as sort of a generative catalyst to seeing themselves as connected to one another. So we see Georgians and Tennesseans through violence having common cause and building this identity through the dispossession of a group like the Creek, for instance.
The removal of Florida Indians, primarily during the Second Seminole War, played a critical role in this process of white Southerner coalescence.
The expulsion of the Florida Indians is a really catalytic moment in the coalescence of the white South. What we refer to as becoming the Second Seminole War, this conflict between 1835 and 1842 for the forced expulsion of Florida's indigenous populations, is something that becomes sort of a reference point for white Southerners of this time. We often think of forced removal as a federally led effort. Supposedly the U.S. military is the one handling everything. But for the forced removal of the Seminole Indians and the conflict that comes about as a result of Seminole Indians' resistance to their expulsion from their homelands is going to be one that's very much led and at least early on fought by white Southerners. And in response, we are going to see outrage across the white South, that there is an uproar for the need for decisive and overwhelming action. The city of Charleston, South Carolina, in particular, is going to be in a lot of ways leading the charge with having town hall meetings, looking to organize volunteers, looking to provide supplies, people who have boats offering transportation, both for volunteer soldiers heading to Florida and then for any Florida settlers who want to flee the area. So we're going to see South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana really take the lead in providing volunteers for this effort to what they say defend the Florida settlers, but was in effect to basically expel and remove Florida Seminoles, other Florida Indians from the peninsula. We're going to see Florida, Georgia, and Alabama each provide about more than 2,000 volunteers in the first couple years of this conflict. And it is going to be one that sort of presents this rallying cry of common cause for the civic militaristic obligation that these states feel towards one another in tandem with Florida settlers who are volunteering as well to fight in this conflict.
How white volunteers remembered the conflict of the Second Seminole War hardened the fusion of white Southern identity.
we see lots of ways in which there's going to be sort of an immediate memorialization of this conflict. Shortly after the war starts, basically after the first wave of volunteers gets home, they begin writing about it. And they begin writing about it in sort of a connection to a deeper past. So much so that one author in particular, a volunteer who's named Meyer M. Cohen from Charleston, South Carolina, he is going to write about South Carolina's connection to this colonial past of displacing indigenous peoples and supposedly being victims of indigenous resistance to dispossession. And Meyer M. Cohen is going to specifically relate basically his ancestors or South Carolina's white ancestors as fighting in this conflict now as a continuation of this need to provide protection for the Florida settlers. Meyer M. Cohen will even make some dubious claims about a Seminole supposedly having, he described it, sort of the blood of the Yamasee that his colonial forefathers had fought against. And now it's our obligation, in sort of his words, to provide assistance in this once defeated enemy, now resurging in the 1830s and 1840s. And then on the other end, we see author named A.B. Meek provide a journal of his experience, and then he's going to go on and write some regional histories where he puts the Second Seminole War into, again, sort of this broader context. He is going to write about DeSoto, about the Spanish colonial past in reference to the Second Seminole War, actually look to celebrate some of these conquistadors that are invading the Southeast, disrupting indigenous towns, laying waste to the region for indigenous communities. So we see this change in historical interpretations, basically to, again, to very much reflect in a positive light their own experience as people who are supposedly defending settlers, bringing civilization to these regions of the country rather than being conquerors and destroyers.
Other regional memories formed around white victimization in light of the violence inflicted by indigenous peoples' resistance against settler dispossession.
One of these instances occurs with violence against a woman just outside of Jacksonville named Jane Hall Johns. And Jane Johns is a lot of ways going to become sort of, for lack of a better word, sort of a poster child for the victimization of settlers at the start of this conflict. When we sort of write about the Second Seminole War in the history textbooks, we look at the assassination of the Indian agent, we look at what becomes Dade Massacre, but there are also going to be violence against settlers as the Florida Indians look to secure their borders against encroaching settlers. And one of those acts of violence that becomes useful, sort of a political tool at the time, is when Florida Indians raid settlement of the Johns, just outside, just west of Jacksonville. Jane's husband will be killed. Jane will be very brutally assaulted, so much so that the people who are attacking this household assume she is dead. She is going to be unsuccessful in being able to basically barricade her door. The intruders will enter her household. She will be shot. She will be struck. Famously, she will be scalped. The house will be set on fire, but she will survive. And she will be found by her father-in-law, basically clinging to life near a small pond nearby her homestead. Miraculously, she is going to recover. She is going to be cared for by a Jacksonville physician named Andrew Welch. But what Andrew Welch, the physician, ends up doing is leveraging her victimization. He is going to write a book about her experience. They are going to go on a tour of major southeastern port towns, in which she is going to basically be an exhibition, both as a medical exhibition and then one as an exhibition of settler victimization. The story of Jane Johns is going to be printed about sort of in the same columns that are going to relay stories about the war effort to expel the Florida Indians. So you have this very personal, individualized example of Native resistance creating victims out of settlers as Southern militias are destroying Indian towns, are rounding up Florida Indians for expulsion to Indian territory west of the Mississippi River. And at the same time, that it's not sort of a coincidence that she's getting a lot of fanfare in cities like Savannah and Charleston. The city of Charleston is not only sending out or volunteers of the Florida Peninsula, but they are also receiving the bodies of the wounded and the deceased. So we see this intersection of how sort of interpersonal interactions, the personalization of victimization, and then memory of these instances are going to perpetuate themselves. And Jane Johns in particular is going to be remembered for a long time. She's going to, as I said, survive. She's going to return to Florida. She is going to move to Southwest Florida, where she will live with a brother-in-law late in her life. And when she dies, basically towards the end of the 19th century, she is going to be remembered by her family, basically for this violence against her. F.C. Bodges is going to write about her in his memoir and use her basically as a way to claim ownership of this Southwest Florida where he resides. And we're going to see that then later, almost a century later, she will be remembered by Southwest Florida when a local historical society puts a placard on her grave in 1985. Jane is not going to have a traditional headstone. She is going to have this placard that basically reads by her remarried name, Miss Jane Matthews, scalped September 16th, 1836. And that's what identifies her grave today. Is this act of violence against her, not when she was born or even when she died.
Dr. Noe hopes that readers of his book gain a deeper understanding of the centrality of the erasure of an indigenous past in Florida to the formation of white Southern identity in the antebellum period.
I hope to express with this book is the role that Florida plays in the history of the American South. We often sort of forget about Florida, especially when we're talking about the 19th century South, often in preference for places like Alabama or Mississippi or even Texas. But I think with centering violence against Native peoples and the erasure of an indigenous past, we can see that Florida plays a foundational role sort of in that process, in that broader regional process. And we can look to events like the Second Seminole War and the participation of thousands of Southern volunteers as Florida being a critical component of this creation of a regional consciousness, one that often gets overlooked in sort of larger regional histories with oftentimes more of a focus on what we today sort of more look at as these sort of iconic Southern states, whether it be sort of the Alabamas or the South Carolinas or the Virginians. So I certainly hope that people who are reading this book can take away that, that Florida plays a very critical role in the creation of the American South.
Dr. F. Evan Noe is the author of Aggression and Sufferings, Settler Violence, Native Resistance, and the Coalescence of the Old South, published by the University of Alabama Press. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Sebastian Garcia, and Connie Lester will be back next week. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.